This podcast miniseries is supported by a grant from AstraZeneca. Asthma exacerbations continue to affect over 40% of asthma patients each year, which not only disrupts their quality of life, but can lead to permanent loss of lung function. The goal of this podcast series, Shifting the Asthma Rescue Paradigm, is to review why an anti-inflammatory reliever has become the standard of care in asthma management, and can also to provide tips on how to implement this therapy in your practice. Hello, everyone. My name is Jerry Lee. I'm an associate professor at Emory University and the host of this second part in a three-part miniseries entitled Shifting the Asthma Rescue Paradigm, a Call to Action from the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. In this episode, we will discuss implementation strategies of an anti-inflammatory reliever in mild asthma patients. And in the next episode, we'll discuss the maintenance and reliever therapy in more moderate to severe asthma patients. I'm excited today to be joined by two experts in the field of asthma. Our first expert is Dr. Leonard Bacarrier. He is the Janie Robinson and John Moore Lee Chair in Pediatrics at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He is a professor of pediatrics and allergy immunology pulmonary medicine, and he is the scientific director of the Center for Clinical and Translational Research at Vanderbilt. Dr. Bacarrier's career has been focused on clinical research to help understand and improve the care of children with asthma, and his clinical translational research efforts are directed at the pathogenesis of asthma in early life and approaches to asthma management throughout childhood, including multi-center, federally funded clinical trials in asthma. Len, thank you so much for joining the podcast.
Thanks, Jerry. Great to be here.
Our second expert is Dr. William Anderson. He is an associate professor of pediatrics at Children's Hospital Colorado and the University of Colorado School of Medicine. He is the medical director for the allergy and immunology section. Dr. Anderson's clinical and scholarly interests include the management of difficult-to-treat and severe asthma, pediatric to adult care transition, and technology and medicine, including electronic medication monitoring. He directs the Multidisciplinary Asthma Clinic and their Asthma Biologics Program. Dr. Anderson also leads hospital-wide pediatric to adult transition initiatives for Children's Hospital Colorado as the co-director of the Improving Pediatric to Adult Care Transition or IMPACT program. Bill, welcome again to the podcast.
Thanks, Jerry. Happy to be back.
Okay, well, let's get started again. In the last episode, we reviewed the rationale for an anti-inflammatory reliever. Just to catch us up again, Len, could you give a quick definition of what a AIR or anti-inflammatory reliever is?
Sure, Jerry. So historically in asthma, we have provided rapid onset bronchodilators in the form of short-acting beta agonists, most typically albuterol. And these are what we have long considered our conventional relievers. They are pure bronchodilators with no anti-inflammatory properties. As emerging research has really taught us, inflammation is the cornerstone to asthma. It is the driving factor of exacerbations, and people have long wanted to improve our ability to prevent exacerbations. And the concept of AIR is sort of a natural outgrowth of that. And it's really the concept that anytime rescue is required, instead of just providing a simple bronchodilator, we actually provide an additional bolus of inhaled corticosteroid to provide inflammation at times where clearly inflammation is present because symptoms are present. This can be done with rapid onset bronchodilators such as albuterol or formoterol. These have different durations of action but are comparable in their acute onset. And we are able to deliver this as either a single inhaler strategy or in multiple inhalers, depending on the clinical situation and availability.
So we're going to focus today's episode on the implementation of AIR on a typical patient. So let me start with a typical case, just a grounded discussion. Let's say you see a 23-year-old college student with a history of seasonal allergic rhinitis and asthma. She really only mentions her asthma during your visit because you asked her. She only uses her albuterol inhaler less than twice a month. And, you know, she had this one urgent care visit last year requiring prednisone, but that was due to influenza. And, you know, that's a part of asthma. You do spirometry today, and she doesn't have any evidence of obstruction. So, Bill, when you see a patient like this, what does the asthma guideline tell us on how to approach this?
So I would classify, Jerry, this patient as having intermittent asthma, given the relative paucity of her symptoms and the lack of recurrent exacerbations. So when we think about the guidelines, we have two options on the table. One is our NHLBI guidelines, and the other is our Global Initiative for Asthma, or GINA, guidelines. So our NHLBI guidelines were last updated in 2020, and at that time, they said that the preferred option for this patient would be as-needed SABA. I would say that is 2020. That's several years ago now, and we have greater evidence. And as we discussed in the first podcast, there is great evidence for why we should be using an anti-inflammatory in addition to a reliever therapy. So in this case, I defer to GINA, which says that the preferred treatment option would be to take a low-dose ICS formoterol as needed. An alternative therapy for that could be to use ICS with a SABA, and that could either be in a combined inhaler if available or as two individual inhalers.
So really, the updated guidelines, even since 2020, has suggested that we should use an anti-inflammatory reliever. What was the rationale or research cited by GINA to change this guideline?
So this is really a paradigm shift in our thinking toward asthma care, and it was based on a very substantial body of evidence. The first bit of evidence that's essential to recall is that SABA alone has never been demonstrated to be an effective approach in preventing exacerbations. It is a reactive therapy, and there are no data that show that giving SABA proactively is in any way preventive of exacerbations. Second point is that there's substantial evidence that unopposed regular SABA use actually augments and increases airway hyperresponsiveness and decreases the bronchoprotective effects of short-acting beta agonists. So there's actually a true detriment to airway physiology with unopposed SABA use. There were two very large trials reported in the last several years that really studied this carefully. They were called Sigma 1 and Sigma 2. The Sigma 1 trial enrolled over 3,800 patients with mild asthma. And it showed that the use of as-needed ICS formoterol without any background therapy at all provided better symptom control than patients who received just as-needed SABA. But if you compared that to patients who received daily ICS, it wasn't quite as good at day-to-day symptom control. However, if you look at the more extreme example of asthma activity, that is exacerbation rates, they were actually similar between the as-needed ICS formoterol group and the group that received daily inhaled corticosteroids. And both of these were significantly lower than as-needed SABA. And finally, that ICS exposure was actually lowest in the group that received as-needed ICS formoterol. This was accompanied by a trial named Sigma 2, had a little over 4,200 patients. And this one clearly demonstrated that using an AIR approach, that is ICS formoterol, was superior to using SABA alone for rescue and was not inferior to daily ICS on the risk of severe exacerbations in patients with mild asthma. Furthermore, the group that used ICS formoterol for rescue alone used 1/4 the amount of ICS. There have also been several studies that have studied the examination of PRN-ICS SABA and have also shown that there are lower rates of exacerbation compared to SABA alone. The literature is entirely consistent that the addition of an inhaled corticosteroid to a rescue bronchodilator reduces the risk of exacerbation at least as well as daily low-dose inhaled corticosteroid and potentially better.
So, you know, Len, you've quoted two studies with thousands of patients that has a substantial evidence, just a substitution of a rescue inhaler that contains inhaled storin can really move the needle on exacerbations. But we're finding that that's not often implemented in practice. And Bill, what do you think are the barriers to this implementation if we just have such substantial evidence?
I think one substantial barrier is just a lack of knowledge about this evidence. Oftentimes, providers are hesitant to do things that aren't outlined specifically in the guidelines. And most providers, I feel, are very familiar with NHLBI, and more so now they're coming around to GINA. And so as we talk about this, as it gets incorporated into guidelines, I think we're going to start seeing some practice changes. Beyond the providers, also, this is a bit of a departure for patients who for years had been told, well, this medicine is a controller, this is a rescue, don't take this one on demand, do this one every day. So the idea that maybe they're getting some steroid just on demand or at the same time as a rescue is a new concept for them. And so that takes some paradigm change in the way they approach it. And then finally, we obviously have to think about insurance coverage and access to these drugs, which can vary between plans in different parts of the country and around the world. So there's both the knowledge aspects of it, the approaches, and the logistical aspects of it.
Yes, I think we've all encountered those barriers. I've definitely had pharmacists ask me, and I'm obviously going to send them the guidance as well. So I absolutely relate to everything you've said. So, you know, we started with a more mild patient, but let's talk about someone with potentially more severe asthma. Let's say you have the patient come back and now they're having twice weekly symptoms. They meet criteria for step two asthma therapy. Len, how does the guidelines approach step two therapy versus the intermittent patient?
So as symptom frequency increases or exacerbation risk increases, our two guidelines actually are not in sync with one another at this point. If you view the GINA 2024 report, the preferred approach for somebody like this would be a PRN as needed ICS formoterol as a AIR strategy. But an alternative could be a daily low dose ICS with as needed SABA added, or the strategy of using an ICS whenever a SABA is taken as a two inhaler strategy. And that's supported by the data we discussed. The NAEPP update in 2020 does not include this as-needed ICS formoterol option as unopposed therapy. And this is likely due to the fact of the timing that when the 2020 update was developed, these Sigma trials were not yet fully available and therefore could not be considered in their determination. And thus, they recommend daily low-dose ICS as the recommended approach, but do acknowledge that the ICS strategy whenever a SABA is taken is indeed an alternative that can be considered, and that is the AIR approach.
Let's lay out three different approaches from the guidelines, whether that's being ICS formoterol, ICS SABA, or even again, the older guidelines with daily ICS as needed SABA. So, Bill, navigating those options, what are sort of your approach in this step two therapy and the implementation of the guidelines?
As Len laid out very well at the start of this, we have great evidence for this ICS formoterol on demand approach or ICS SABA on demand approach versus a daily ICS, with the idea being that the daily ICS, you're also getting a greater exposure to a steroid. So if all things are being equal, my approach would be to use the ICS formoterol on demand in this population, as that is the preferred recommendations from the guidelines. However, if for different reasons that's not available, whether it is an insurance or an access issue or through shared decision-making, that's something that the family or the patient doesn't feel comfortable with. In this case, for patients 12 years and older, GINA would recommend the daily low-dose ICS with the reliever being ICS SABA, as Len has outlined, or just as needed SABA. So once again, we have a preferred approach. We have evidence for why that is the preferred approach, but if that is not feasible, then we can kind of defer back to what we've maybe been a little bit more accustomed to in this situation, which is a daily controller therapy with on-demand, with that on-demand potentially including an AIR option.
So Bill mentioned a lot of these guides also focus on 12 to above. And so I think we should talk about younger patients. Len, is there a different approach for the implementation of an anti-inflammatory reliever for 5 to 11?
So we enter a bit of an evidence light zone as we get into the school age population, in that we're really limited, but do have a couple of well-conducted randomized control trials called TREX and ASSIST that both examined whether the use of separate inhalers, one containing inhaled corticosteroid and one containing SABA, and whenever SABA was needed, additional ICS was provided. And these have been conducted in children as young as 6 years of age. And both studies found that this strategy was indeed superior to SABA alone in terms of risk of exacerbations. So consistent with the data in adolescents and adults, and also associated with lower overall inhaled corticosteroid exposure, which is a very favorable outcome in this age group.
Bill, what about the under 5 population? Do we have anything similar to the school age children about the evidence for AIR?
Thinking about AIR specifically, we do not have robust evidence at this time to recommend this kind of approach. Hopefully in the future, we will have that kind of evidence, but we're not there yet. So I want to be clear that when we're talking about this 4 and under, we're not thinking about AIR. However, there is one approach that can be used as an on-demand therapy in this younger 0 to 4 age patient population who has exclusively viral-induced symptoms. So if they're having any kind of symptoms outside of a viral-induced exacerbation, for example, difficulty with exercise or day-to-day symptoms, we don't want to use this approach. But in this approach, with this patients who have these viral-induced or illness-induced exacerbations, you can start high-dose inhaled steroid at the very first onset of illness. The study that explored this was the MIST trial, and they used 1 milligram of budesonide twice daily at the very first onset of illness and used it for 7 days and used it in conjunction with a reliever therapy, in this case, albuterol. So what I would say is that if you have a patient that wants to use this kind of approach, it's a great way to make sure that they're being treated during their exacerbations. It's also a great way to reduce their overall steroid exposure during it, as the study showed that it was comparable to being on a daily low-dose inhaled corticosteroid in terms of time to first exacerbation, but the kids overall got significantly less inhaled steroid approach with using this on-demand therapy.
Bill, thank you for that summary, and Len as well. I think, you know, we're all challenged on the implementation of different groups or ages, but this is a very good starting point. So that concludes part 2 of this 3-part series. In the next episode, we'll talk about the more moderate severe patient and maintenance reliever therapy. For other interesting episodes from Allergy Talk, please visit education.acaai.org/allergytalk. This is Jerry Lee for the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. Have a wonderful day.